This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Society constantly changes, and from time to time, the law has to change as well to keep up. With that thought in mind, an influential group of lawyers and judges has been looking at laws that apply to the family, or, well, to the dissolution of the family, to be more specific. After 10 years of study, the American Law Institute has indeed decided that the modern American family needs a more modern divorce law. They've issued a set of recommendations that cover everything from child custody to child support to alimony to the legal rights of gay couples and unmarried parents. Today, we're going to go through their recommendations. Later in the program, we'll hear from a critic who says that some of their suggestions undercut the sanctity of marriage, and we want to hear from you. Have you been through the process of divorce? Did you think that the law was up to the task? What changes do you think need to be made to the laws governing the breakup of families? Our telephone number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now on the phone from her office in Los Angeles is Grace Gans Bloomberg. She was one of the authors of the New Principles published by the American Law Institute. She's a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches property and family law. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. First of all, can you tell us a little bit about the American Law Institute? What is this group? Who belongs to it? What's its purpose?
Well, the American Law Institute was founded in 1923. And at that time, it stated, I'll quote its purpose, it's a brief purpose, statement of purpose, to promote the clarification and simplification of the law and its better adaptation to social needs, to secure the better administration of justice, and to encourage and carry on scholarly and scientific legal work. To that end, the Institute drafts and publishes various restatements of the law, model codes, and other proposals for legal reform. The membership of the Institute consists of judges, practicing attorneys, and legal scholars from all areas in the United States, as well as from some foreign countries. Membership is selected on the basis of professional achievement and demonstrated interest in the improvement of law.
And who is your audience? Who reads this?
Yes. The Institute's restatements, model codes, and legal studies are used as references by judges, attorneys, legislators, and also by law students.
So, obviously, issues like family law, for example, these are largely issues for state legislatures.
Yes. Most of the restatements and the principles deal with state law. Mm-hmm. And so our work on family law is addressed mostly to judges and to state legislatures.
Why did the ALI decide to tackle family law?
Well, for one reason is that they never had done it before. Another is that the increase in the divorce rate that we've seen in the last since really the 30s has made divorce more of an issue.
Mm-hmm.
And because it was also felt the law of divorce was somewhat in disarray and could use a thorough examination. And so the ALI decided to do what they call principles rather than restatement. Restatement normally restates the law and chooses the best rule.
Mm-hmm.
Principles, rather, instead examines the underlying assumptions, the fundamental assumptions of the rules, and starts from scratch. It may end up adopting existing law to some extent, but nevertheless it's intended to be a fundamental rethinking of the way we treat divorce.
Well, let's move on to specifics then, and start with the chapter in your document that deals with non-marital cohabitation. And now, what does that chapter say, and why did you decide to include non-marital cohabitation amongst these recommendations?
Well, we didn't initially. Initially, we were a project that was addressing the termination of lawful marriage. And so we just treated child support, child custody, property distribution, and spousal support.
Mm-hmm.
And we got to the end of our work, and we thought we'd been working for 10 years, and we thought we'd finished. And the judges on our who advise us, we have many consultation groups. The judges said, "You've not finished. We have before us in our courts every day. We have unmarried couples, and the law we have now in the United States to deal with it is unsatisfactory. And we think you should take a good look at it. And we were reluctant, frankly, to do it because it's a hot button issue, and it's obviously the one you asked me.
First.
And it's the we did what we thought were the bread and butter issues, and we wanted people to pay attention to them. So we were afraid this would be a distraction. We think it's an important topic, but we were afraid it would be a distraction.
But from what I read, the judges said like something like 20% of their cases in these areas are unmarried people.
One judge said that, who was particularly insistent that we do it, that we really hadn't finished our job. It's not as though the law has never treated these. There is no law that applies to unmarried cohabitation. In fact, there is in the United States now the fairly well-known doctrine of Marvin versus Marvin.
This was the famous palimony case, right?
The palimony case, exactly, which has been adopted in most states, uses the law of contract rather than the law of divorce when an unmarried cohabitants come to the end of the road. But we felt that that law wasn't working out well. The judges particularly felt that law wasn't working out well, that it was not yielding just results, and that it was very difficult to administer, unnecessarily difficult to administer, and they asked us to rethink the subject. This was an area in which we looked comparatively. We looked to our closest common law neighbors, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and we found that they took a very different approach to non-marital cohabitation.
And when you say common law, you mean based on English common law?
English common law, right. What we have in common with these cultures besides a language is a legal system.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw that they were bringing these couples into their divorce law. They were saying these people live like they're married even if they're not formally married. They share a life together as though they were married. Therefore, when their long-term stable cohabitations come to an end, we should treat them as though they were married. And we found that approach appealing. It's one that is responsive to the underlying tenor of the entire project, which is that the basis for distributing property and support at divorce, at the end of a lawful marriage, is not contract, but rather is based on equitable considerations that arise over the course of the party's relationship. And we felt that in this sense, that in long-term stable non-marital cohabitation, the couples are indistinguishable from married persons for our purposes. And our purpose is narrow, and that should be understood.
Mm-hmm.
We're not treating these people as though they're married for all purposes. Our only issue here is what are the rights and obligations of one of them to the other when their relationship comes to an end.
So, in other words, if you look at a relationship, and if it, this is the old, if it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it is a duck.
Exactly.
All right. Some people have suggested that by treating them equally in the eyes of the law, you are somehow elevating cohabitation to be equal status with marriage.
Well, I don't think that's the case, because this is really an assignment of obligations. Not marriage consists of many rights. That we have many public and private rights that arise from marriage. Rights from a third party, from states. We could see marriage as a protective umbrella of incidents. The cohabitants are not getting those rights. Rather, they're getting obligations to each other in our system, because we're not trying to cover the field. We have limited scope of the project. So we are not treating these people as though they're married for purposes of Social Security benefits, workers' comp, tax benefits, and so forth. We're simply saying what should be done equitably when their relationship comes to an end. We've got to decide what should be done economically as between the parties.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, our email address, TOTN@NPR.org. And our first caller is Dorian, who's on the line with us from Boston.
Hi, I'm calling because this is really my line of work. I'm the founder of an organization called the Alternatives to Marriage Project.
Mm-hmm.
And so we work with unmarried couples all the time. And I have to say that these new recommendations from the American Law Institute have been really controversial among our members. It's really sparked a lot of conversation. Some people, of course, are very upset because they're choosing not to marry because they don't want the government to treat them like a married couple. They've made the choice to opt out. But on the other hand, I think there's a lot of value here, a lot of positive for us to think about because of the more vulnerable people who are living together unmarried and don't realize that they really have very few protections. We hear some really horrible, sad stories from couples who are together for a long, long time, break up, and are shocked to find out that legally they're strangers in the eyes of the law if they haven't, really created contracts, as your guest was saying. So in general, we really think this is a great idea and important, although I guess one of the key things is the idea that you can opt out. You could write something that says these laws won't apply to us and we're going to write our own contract.
Yes, absolutely. We provide that parties can always agree to the contrary. Effectively, we see what we've done as a set of default rules for people who have not made an agreement. We don't want to impose the duties of marriage on people who clearly have made a contract to the contrary.
I think that's great. And it seems like one of the things that a lot of people find important is that these kinds of laws or assumptions not kick in too soon. You know, I think it might make more sense for things like this to happen when people have been together for 3 years or 5 years or even 7 years, like the old myth about common law marriage.
7 years, yeah.
Heard 7 years, even though that isn't necessarily true.
It isn't true at all.
Yeah. But that way, you know, we really are talking about people who are in pretty long-term relationships and treating those people as married, not treating the people who just moved in together. I think a lot of people have been very worried about that.
Yes, well, no, that we have threshold requirements, and this is, it's up to the state that adopts the rule. But we suggest that the minimum requirements, and states could certainly have higher numbers, minimum requirement would be 2 years if there's a child born to the parties.
That's great.
And if there is no child born, 3 years. But certainly it wouldn't matter if the number of years were increased.
Yeah. Well, I think we still have a long way to go in this country in terms of updating our legal codes, and this is just, you know, one small step. There is still a lot of other areas to look at, but it's a great start.
Well, there's an endorsement. Dorian, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
All right. Just an idea on timing for these recommendations. Over what period of time do you expect that people will be looking at these and looking to see if that's what they want for their states?
Well, that's up to the states. It depends on the issue. For example, child support is regularly reviewed by federal mandate every 4 years. So we expect our child support chapter will be looked at in these regular reviews. But on the other issues, it's entirely up to the legislature of a state, of a particular state, whether it's interested in pursuing the issue or not.
Given your, going by precedent, which of course everybody in the legal profession likes a lot, given past recommendations, how long does it take usually?
I really can't say.
All right. We're going to be discussing child support when we come back after the break. Our telephone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Grace Gans Bloomberg, a law professor at UCLA's School of Law and co-author of The Principles of the Law of Family Dissolution, which has just been published by the American Law Institute. And as I understand, it's just about to come out in paperback?
I've been told, yes.
All right, so that'll make it more widely available.
It's also available online.
And where would that be?
That would be on LexisNexis.
All right, well, if you want to get a closer look at some of these recommendations, go there. We'll be back after a break. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about new guidelines proposed by the American Law Institute that would reform laws dealing with divorce and the breakup of families. Our guest is Grace Gans Bloomberg, a law professor at UCLA's School of Law, one of the authors of the new guidelines. Of course, you're invited to join our discussion. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. And why don't we move to some of the other areas that you write about and talk about child custody for a moment. How would that change?
The child custody chapter could I just talk a little about the principles that would guide all the chapters, and then
sure.
You'll see how it works out in each one that you ask about.
Okay.
What we were interested in rules that would yield predictable results, that would yield consistent results in like cases, but at the same time would respond sensitively to differences among families. We didn't want cookie-cutter rules.
Mm-hmm.
And so in child custody, the first and most important point is that, and this has been done in some states, so it's not a novelty in this work, but the parents would be required to provide the court with a parenting plan for their children. And only if they could not agree, and in most cases parents do agree, it's a small minority of cases that they don't agree, but if they don't agree, the operative rule would be a presumption that the custodial responsibility would be awarded according to the past caretaking practices of the parents. This would have the effect of maintaining the caretaking status quo. And this would apply unless the court finds that there is an enumerated reason to do otherwise. And this is a way of fleshing out the rather nebulous best interest of the child rule,
mm-hmm.
which often leads to a lot of litigation and uncertainty. This is a way of creating certainty of responding to the particular family. For example, if the family, if one party were effectively the sole caretaker, that party would have primary custody. If both the husband and wife shared equally in child caring, there would be a presumption in favor of joint custody. So it would depend on what the parties had done in the past rather than on some general rule that doesn't respond to the circumstances of the family itself.
As you know, a lot of people believe that the current system is slanted towards the mother, that the mother is almost always awarded custody. Would this perpetuate that?
To the extent that the mother has been the caretaker of the child, it would maintain her in that position. To the extent she has not, it would not. I mean, it wouldn't. There would be no preference for mothers. There would simply be a preference for persons who have been caring for the child. In fact, you know that view is not correct, though. When fathers do contest custody, they do ask for custody. They have a better track record than mothers. In other words, in most cases, mothers get custody by default, but in contested cases, fathers are likely to be more successful.
We have an email question from Stuart Johnson in Oklahoma City. I'm currently going through a divorce. I've been, quote, dad, unquote, to my stepson from 5 years of age to 14. Mm-hmm. Now he's out of my life. I have no legal rights to see him. Do these new guidelines deal with the rights of step-parents?
In terms of child custody, the question would be whether he was, the extent to which he was involved as a de facto parent. I'm not going to answer that question fully because I have not had an opportunity to review the child custody provisions. We certainly have we have provisions for de facto caretakers.
Yeah, but there is that concept of a de facto parent.
Yes.
Okay. Let's move on now to child support. How would that change?
The child support formula, every state has a child support formula. And originally we were going to go with the flow on that and take the majority rule in this country. And the more we looked at the formula, the more we realized it was inadequate. And what we've done is refined the formula so that it takes into account the relative and absolute economic circumstances of the custodial household and the non-custodial parent. The effect of the formula would be to raise child support when it's the lower income parent who has child custody.
but to lower child support when it's the higher income parent who has child custody.
Okay. There's some calls on this. Let's go to Jennifer in St. Louis. Jennifer?
Thank you for taking my call.
All right,
I was answering my landline.
Okay.
I guess I'm just curious to know if we will ever be able to see a cap on child support, particularly in cases of the accidental pregnancies. I think that child support is often a very lucrative way to, for example, pay your rent tax-free and not have to worry about it for 18 years. So I'm curious to know if we will ever see a cap on child support,
well,
and if so, when?
Well, let's let Grace Bloomberg answer.
Okay. That's beyond the scope of the principles. You're really asking a question of whether an accidental parent should be treated as a parent at all.
Well, I guess it stems from the fact that women in this country have a choice as to whether or not they want to be a parent in the event of a pregnancy, but men do not.
Yeah, that is beyond the scope of our undertaking.
But an interesting question, nevertheless,
it's
Jennifer.
It's an interesting question. It's been much debated. Generally, the conclusion, and as I say, this is not in the principles, but generally the conclusion is that the child is the hapless victim and is entitled to support.
Sure, but that would, you know, if you put a cap on things, then people's actions tend to change and their behavior tends to change. And every other industry in the country has protection for fraud.
You're interested in using child support to create disincentives for fraud.
Sure.
Yeah. No. I just want to know where you were coming from, right? Okay, so you're concerned about a particular abuse of
well, yes, and then the equity of it, because, you know, the idea that a woman can get into a relationship and get out at any point, but then she can continue to tap into finances and increase those finances if the increase, to me, is ridiculous, because if you got out of the relationship at a certain point, who says you should continue to climb the ladder? If you leave the restaurant after you've eaten the dinner, they don't owe you dinner anymore. You know what I mean?
Jennifer, your cell phone is beginning to go wonky on us. But
okay, well, thank you for my call.
Thanks very much.
Okay.
All right, let's go on now to Yvonne, who joins us from Scottsdale, Arizona.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, if you live in one state and your ex-spouse moves to another state, and you have an enforcement to receive your child support, but that individual stops paying. And it doesn't matter that you're in the system. The system really isn't designed to assist you.
Well, we do have an interstate Child Support Enforcement Act that is set up to
yes,
do that.
Yes, I've heard of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really, well, maybe it does in 5 or 10 years of when your child leaves your home, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't seem to be effective.
There are certainly enormous problems of enforcement in this country. And that's beyond the scope of what we were trying to do.
I see.
But they're very serious problems.
Okay, Yvonne, thanks very much.
Thank you.
All right. Joining us now from his office in Tempe, Arizona, is Ira Ellman. He's a law professor at Arizona State University's College of Law, and welcome to you.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, you were part of the team, along with Grace Gans Bloomberg, that worked on these new proposals, and you were particularly involved in the development and writing of findings of fault when it comes to alimony and property distribution. Can you tell us what you recommended?
Well, I suppose I turn that around and say we recommended that there not be findings of fault and that not be part of the process through which decisions on alimony or the allocation of marital property be reached. And in doing that, I should say and make clear that we were not really charting some dramatic new ground. About 35 states today already have a no-fault principle with respect to marital property, and as to alimony, the states are about evenly divided, half and half. So we had, models to choose from and experience of the states to look at, and we made the same recommendation that the Commissioners on Uniform Laws made when they addressed this question 30 years ago. which was that these matters should be decided without regard to any inquiry into marital fault.
So that if in the process of the divorce case somebody says one partner or the other was having an affair, that shouldn't enter into the decision about division of property.
No, it's just it wouldn't. I think it wouldn't even be that testimony wouldn't even be admissible because it wouldn't be relevant to the question, and so there'd be no reason to hear it. And if you think about it, how would you do it? You won't have a rule that says, well, we're going to reduce the, say the wife would be the one asking for alimony, just to use the most common, although certainly not universal example. You're going to reduce her alimony by 10% for each incident of adultery, or you're going to increase the husband's by 10% for each time that, that he did that. You can see right off that any kind of rule of that kind, clear rule, would probably lead to absurd results. And so you're left really, and there's a few states that do it, this is largely what they do, to the discretion of the trial judge. And then you get a potentially biased and unpredictable outcome.
The arbitrariness of it, was that a principal motivation to try to get these standardized?
Well, the arbitrariness was certainly one very important point, because arbitrariness in the sense that it would be very hard for parties to know what would happen. And perhaps if you knew the identity of the judge that was going to be assigned to your case, maybe then an experienced local practitioner who knew the personalities might be able to offer a prediction, but that doesn't seem like a good system either. As I think Grace said earlier, getting predictability into the system was one of our guiding lights, and that's inconsistent with allowing this kind of judicial discretion over fault. There's also value judgments that inevitably would be made by judges in doing this that are going to be all over the map. A traditionally minded judge might be more offended by a party's adultery than another judge, or may be offended by her wife's failure to be very assiduous in her homemaking duties or something like that. I mean, that would, you could see all kinds of possible biases that could really warp the system.
Given what you say are obvious absurdities, do you foresee a day when all divorces in this country will be no-fault divorces?
Well, as I say, right now almost every state is no fault with regard to grounds. That is, you can get a divorce without having to prove fault. I think there's only three states left in which that's not the case. And most of them are no fault with regard to property and half an alimony. Now, even those that officially allow the consideration of fault, the other 15 states in property, the half an alimony, often have, They try to contain it. There'll be appellate decisions that say, only if it's very egregious or something like that. It's a problem because they have difficulty laying down clear rules about how to contain it, but there's often a local culture. Certainly when we talk to practitioners and judges who are in our advisory group on this question, it's often the case that even though if you just read the statute, you might think the fault was something that could be considered, that just really wasn't the practice anymore.
Well, Ira Ellman, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Ira Ellman is a law professor at Arizona State University's College of Law. He was one of the authors of The Principle of the Law of Family Dissolution, and he was on the line with us from his office in Tempe, Arizona. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And joining us now from our bureau in New York is David Blankenhorn. He's president of the Institute for American Values, an organization whose mission is to promote marriage and family life. Good of you to join us today. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
You've been listening to our discussion. You're familiar with the proposals of the American Institute of Law. What's your reaction?
Some of the proposals are fine. The one that I most object to is the proposal that would largely eliminate the law's ability to make distinctions between married and unmarried persons. You've talked about this a bit.
Mm-hmm.
In the name of, equalizing all relationships in the eyes of the law, these recommendations would essentially get rid of marriage as a protected legal relationship. And despite the fairly mild language that introduces this proposal, it is anything but mild. It is a very blunt attempt to use the law to redefine what marriage is. And so just to take one example, it would knock out the notion of choice as a basis for marriage. Marriage, one of the core meanings of marriage is that people say, I do. They voluntarily, consciously make the choice to be married. What would happen under these regulations is that, on the one hand, married people would see themselves being treated just like any other relationship in the eyes of the law, and lots of unmarried people would find themselves sort of involuntarily drafted into a marriage-like legal regime without them ever knowing that they have been involved in such a thing. So the whole, whenever you collapse the distinctions between a married person and an unmarried person, and you say, well, we're just going to treat everybody the same as long as they're in a sexual relationship, you do a lot of bad things. First of all, to married people, and second of all, to people who don't want to get married. So I think it's quite a bad idea.
What would be the bad things that would happen to married people?
Well, historically, societies have all said we value this relationship called marriage. Mm-hmm. Despite the comments that are in the document and despite some of the comments that your guests have made, marriage is not just a formality, just a piece of paper. It's a real commitment that people make to one another. And it's in the best interest of children and society to have this marriage system function in a good way. That's why we have marriage laws, to say this is a good thing. Society has a vested interest in having a good, protected marriage system. We have marriage laws because we want to define what that means and to make rules for entry into the institution and exit from it. This is all very important if you care about children, if you care about marriage. Now, what would happen is if you say to people, well, you can still continue to get married in your heart, you can go to church, you can have a religious belief about it in your local community, but when it comes to the law, you're just one more close relationship. You're no different from people down the street who've just been living together for a while. That has a weakening and confusing effect on, well, what does it mean to be married? And that would further weaken the institution of marriage by making the marriage relationship more and more just like just any other living together relationship. Children have not been mentioned in this discussion yet. If you want to hurt children, make their lives less promising and fulfilling, the best way to do it is to mess up the married couple home.
We're going to continue discussing this issue when we come back on the other side of the break. Our guest will continue to be Grace Ganz Bloomberg, and also with us right now from our Bureau in New York, David Blankenhorn. So give us a call if you'd like to get in on the discussion. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Among the top stories here at NPR News today, the Bush administration is expected to oppose a University of Michigan affirmative action policy in a lawsuit that's headed for the U.S. Supreme Court. The suit was brought by white students who say minority students have an advantage in applying for admission. NPR's Don Gagne will have details on that. The United States has formally asked NATO for indirect assistance in case of war against Iraq. As the American military preparation continues, NPR's Tom Gelton will look at how long the U.S. can keep its forces at the ready. Those stories later today on All Things Considered from NPR News. On Talk of the Nation, we're talking about new recommendations that would change the way that divorce and family laws are interpreted by judges and legislators. Our guests are Grace Ganz Bloomberg, a law professor at UCA Law School and one of the authors of the new guidelines. Also with us, David Blankenhorn, who's president of the Institute for American Values. And Grace Ganz Bloomberg, as you heard Mr. Blankenhorn's criticism, what's your response?
Well, I really don't understand it. Marriage has all sorts of benefits for people. It obviously, as Mr. Blankenhorn says, has an expressive function that's very important to people. And it has all sorts of benefits during the ongoing relationship. We are not giving those benefits to cohabiting couples. Rather, we're establishing some law that will regulate the breakdown of long-term stable cohabitations. I'd just like to point out the reason the judges are concerned with it is because of the demographics of the situation. In the last 30 years, we've seen an eightfold increase in the number of unmarried opposite-sex couples, and more than one-third of these couples have minor children in their household. To the extent we're concerned about these children, we have to be concerned about the dissolution of these relationships. Moreover, there are three same-sex couples for every 100 married couples. So the total, I mean, when you look at the demographics, 11 unmarried couples for every 100 married couples. To simply ignore these people when their relationship breaks down seems derelict on the part of the law. And that's what the judges were concerned about and why they urged us to deal with these people. I don't see that none of us are interested in discouraging marriage. On the contrary, all the authors and all the members are married people, middle-aged married people. But nevertheless, the law has to deal with what it finds, and what it finds is a situation in which we have increasing numbers of people who are unmarried, many of whom believe, as the caller said, that they are married at common law. The most common myth for unmarried couples is that after 7 years they're married at common law. Of course, that's not true under current law, but they don't know that. And these are the people we're concerned about.
Well, let's get some listeners involved here. Our number again, 800-989-8255. Our next caller is Tony, who's with us from Orfordville, Wisconsin.
Hello, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just would like to kind of lend my support to, I'm sorry, I forgot the name of your other caller, David.
Blankenhorn,
I'm sorry. And I tell you why in 25 words or less, probably. I was involved in a relationship, which I was, you know, cohabitating with a girl in my youth. And I don't know, I guess I would just hate to think about being treated as a married couple when the relationship was over. We were, you know, young and foolish, as young people are sometimes. And, you know, I'm currently happily married. And to me, there's just absolutely no similarity in the way that we approach those relationships, and I would just hate to think how my life would have been probably ruined had I had I had to pay spousal support or whatever the equivalent is. And maybe I'm misunderstanding the proposal, and I don't know if that's a component,
but
wanted to lend my support to Mr. Blankenhorn.
Well, thanks for the call, Tony. Go ahead, Grace Grant.
Yes, I was going to say that we're concerned about long-term cohabitation. All the rights that arise, the economic rights that arise as a function of the duration of the relationship. This caller was concerned about a short-term relationship, probably would not have been included as a cohabitation at all. And certainly if it was not, even if it would have been, if he was young and acquired very little, or it was of short duration, there would have been no economic consequences.
And it would have ended up in court only if they wanted it to be in court, right?
Oh, if someone had a claim to make, yes.
Right, yeah. David Blankenhorn?
Well, with all respect, it's a little disingenuous for Professor Bloomberg to say that there are other aspects of marriage that this document does not touch. In every area of the law that the document concerns itself with, they are absolutely proposing to eliminate the law's ability to make distinctions between married and unmarried persons in the area of family dissolution. And so it's not really right to say that they're not doing that. Secondly, with respect to how to deal with unmarried cohabiting people, there are several answers to that. One is people who are living together and want to enjoy the rights and undertake the obligations of getting married could just get married. Now, for those who don't, there are other ways to handle the problems that arise without knocking out marriage as a protected social institution. Again, despite the very the whole idea of we're simply updating, this is not a very radical proposal, It is a very radical proposal. If you went outside and asked the first 10 people you met, do you think we ought to get rid of marriage as a category for how the law treats people in sexually close relationships, most people would look at you with a funny look in their eye and they'd say, gosh, that's an awfully weird idea. This is exactly what this recommendation is proposing.
Is that true, Grace?
No, I don't agree with that. I mean, I understand what David Blankenhorn is saying, but he seems to be shifting categories. With respect to family dissolution, we are treating stable cohabitation the same as marriage for economic incidents, in other words, support and property. But certainly, the law treats marriage very differently for immigration purposes, for Social Security purposes, for loss of consortium purposes.
But again, Professor, you're simply pointing out topics that this document does not address.
But we
on the areas where you do address, you were proposing a flattening out of the law.
That is accurate, but that doesn't devalue marriage because marriage has all these other benefits, components, expressive components, legal components. All we're talking about is what to do when the family breaks down.
All we're talking about with this document.
Yes.
So you think
it's part of an agenda? Is that the point? An agenda for alternative families, an agenda for the destruction of marriage. My position, my personal position, the position of the Institute, is that marriage is extremely desirable as a social institution, that it's in the interest of the state.
But your document in no way reflects those values.
Your document
reflects the value of marriage as it's a very pint-sized understanding of what marriage is. Over and over again in the document, you say that you use the word formality over and over again, as if marriage was just a piece of paper, a mere private understanding between two parties for their mutual benefit. That's no one else's business. No one should dare make a judgment over who's to blame when something happens.
That's hardly our perspective. In fact, our perspective is extremely child-focused. One of our concerns.
Well, you say here on page 40 of the document.
I was going to say ask one of you to speak at a time, but it's a moot point because, in fact, we're out of time. David Blankenhorn, I understand you're planning a conference of scholars this spring to look at these proposals?
Well, to look at these proposals, which many leading family law scholars are strongly opposed to. So first to look at these proposals, but also more positively to look at ways that law can actually strengthen marriage.
Okay, and I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, but thanks to both of you for joining us today. David Blankenhorn, who we just heard from, president of the Institute for American Values. He was with us from our bureau in New York. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
And Grace Gans Bloomberg, a law professor at UCLA's School of Law, and she spoke to us from her office in Los Angeles. You've been very kind with your time. Appreciate it.
A pleasure.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.